to start things out today, you'll notice there's some construction paper here on the stones and markers and crayons. And I invite you all to take a piece of paper, pass it back to the folks behind you, take a marker or two or three, and just take a moment and draw wilderness. So to recap from yesterday briefly, we were discussing how the notion of wilderness has been passed down to us. It's something that we've inherited. And that notion has been partially informed by the way that wilderness is presented in Scripture, and then has kind of progressed throughout the Christian tradition. And although there's a range of attitudes and different presentations of wilderness, as we talked about yesterday, the negative motif, the one where wilderness is perceived with repulsion, with fear, with suspicion, it's a wasteland, it's sinful, this is the one that had a powerful, pervasive effect on Western thought. So this is the wilderness that's described in the Bible as the great and terrible wilderness, an arid wasteland with poisonous snakes and scorpions, or the desert land, howling wilderness waste, etc. It's presented that way quite often throughout Scripture. And even though there is a contradictory motif that is also at work, the negative motif is the one that that dominated Western thought for centuries. So why does this matter? Again, it's because wilderness is not simply one among a whole laundry list of environmental concerns that some people care about today. It, in many ways, serves as the foundation for many, many, many concerns that on the surface seem very remote from wilderness, but in fact have a whole lot to do with it. And we'll talk more about that as the week goes on, but in brief, in many ways, wilderness sets the standard for what environmentalist conservationists feel that we are aspiring towards. So the way that we think of that wilderness matters quite a lot. So today is about early American thinkers and writers, and not so early, we'll come up until within a few decades of now, who influenced the popular wilderness idea in this country. And as a result, much of the world, as the sort of Western paradigms have infiltrated much of thinking throughout the globe. And in particular, we're interested in some really, really crucial shifts that took place. So notably, wilderness goes from being this worthless wasteland to being essentially beyond price. It's just it's esteemed, it's craved, it's desirable, it's sort of beyond measure how amazing and awesome wilderness becomes. And we're interested in how and why that shift took place. So we have this lovely little interpretive drawing up here, which will serve as the outline, the wordless outline for our talk today. And we're starting in the upper left-hand corner. I don't have a guess of what's going on there. Yeah, so this is, we're gonna talk about the Puritans for a moment. I think this is a lovely Puritan pilgrim that John has drawn on this boat here. So the Puritans were very preoccupied with the wilderness condition of North America, specifically of America and of New England. They were not out there wandering around looking for a meaningful wilderness experience. They were very concerned and fearful of the fact that there was a whole lot of what they considered to be wilderness all around them, and this was a problem. It was perceived by and large very negatively. It was feared, it was loathed, it was meant to be eradicated and replaced with fair farms, a pastoral landscape, a domesticated land, and cities on hills. That was what was, in their mind, was meant to occur in this land that they had arrived in. So wilderness was the antithesis of all that was orderly and good in this paradigm. The early New England colonists saw themselves as Christ's army in a war against wilderness, and against wildness. There's a quick line from John Milton's Paradise Lost where it's juxtaposing Eden and wilderness. And it says, Eden was surrounded by a steep wilderness whose hairy sides access denied. It goes on to talk about it in these very kind of dark and stark terms. So for the Puritans, the polarity between the Garden of Eden and wilderness was really quite strong. And the interpretation of that story as one of loss, of eviction from the Garden of Eden, cemented the idea that wilderness and paradise were spiritual and physical opposites. They simply did not belong together. So that's a kind of simplistic presentation of what the Puritans brought over from Europe with them and kind of used as a foundation in settling America. But a shift takes place, and this shift takes place over many years, but it's pretty profound. And some thinkers argue that that shift actually begins with, of all people, Jonathan Edwards. Does anyone want to remind us real quick who Jonathan Edwards is? Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. He was a Presbyterian, right? Presbyterian
Congregationalist
minister. Go ahead.
And he was probably the most creative theologian that the United States has ever produced.
Yeah? Tell us more.
Okay. He was sort of exiled in Stockbridge, Massachusetts for, something like a dozen years. And he was a missionary to the Indians, a job for which he was supremely unqualified. And he finally got the job for which he was eminently well-suited as president of Princeton University, and he died about two or three months later. Part of his heritage that he bequeathed to us, his grandson was Aaron Burr.
So thanks, that's a good, helpful bio. Jonathan Edwards, go ahead.
Just a little side story, which belongs to the first part of Burton's life. We visited Edinburgh, Scotland, and we stayed in a place called World's End. And World's End was a part of Edinburgh that was on the city wall. And beyond there was disaster and wilderness and everything bad and evil. Everything was out there. And inside was a city. It was called, and it still is called, World's End.
Huh. Interesting. Thanks for sharing that.
Edwards was the starter of the first Great Awakening, so the Great Awakening in the early part of the 18th century, where it looked like that maybe the Puritan vision was dying out, and New England wasn't going to be a religious place. And this return there was more of a warm sense of faith rather than just an intellectual.
Mm-hmm. Comment in the back?
I was going to ask for a time frame.
For a time frame? The Edwards scholar back here can probably give us some more precise dates.
He would have been influential in the first half of the 1700s.
Uh-huh.
No, he was later than that.
1747.
Yeah, well, more than that. In Stockbridge, during the French and Indian War, his home, the manse or whatever they called it, was the biggest and best house in the village. So whenever there was a threat of an Indian attack, the whole town piled into his house. He sent a letter to the Boston Mission Society complaining about his neighbors because they ate up his produce, and he billed the Boston Mission Society for another keg of rum because his neighbors had drunk it all up, which gives us a bit different perception of the Puritan society.
Sure does. Well, so quickly, what I want to say about Jonathan Edwards is that the doctrine of original sin, which was extremely important to Jonathan Edwards, actually plays a role in the beginning of bringing about this profound shift that we're talking about. And the reason why is that Edwards located original sin very specifically not in the increasingly pacified and reduced numbers of Native Americans or First Peoples that they were encountering, and not in the domesticated landscape, but in the hearts of the Euro-Americans that were around him. So these individuals, these people, specifically European Americans, that was where original sin was housed. So their hearts were the stronghold of Satan, and it was not this landscape, specifically this wilderness that was the stronghold of Satan. So emphasizing and locating sin in that particular way, and we see this so profoundly in Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, was in some ways the beginning of bringing about this shift of relocating where sin is. It's perhaps no longer in this desolate, wild wilderness. It's in people, which of course carries its own whole set of issues and concerns. But that's the slow beginning of a shift. Even more profound than that is what happened in this quadrant over here. So this is kind of the beginning of the shift, and this is a much more profound version of the shift. So this is my attempt to draw Henry David Thoreau, because he has all this neck hair. He had this beard that would sort of grow out of his neck, and he always wore bow ties, but that doesn't really look anything like him at all. But the point is that we have this transcendental movement. And the transcendentalists emerged. They were influenced by deism, and they are influenced by the Romantic movement. Can you give us a real quick definition, John, of deism and Romanticism?
Deism is belief in a non-providential God, a God that created the world but does not interact with it. So it's an architect, a clockmaker. God painted this canvas that we live in, this beautiful creation, but that's all. That's deism.
Mm-hmm. And then Romanticism.
Romanticism is a movement most located in continental Europe. In the 18th century is when it emerged. It's literary, artistic, and philosophical. It emphasizes feeling and emotion and passion over cold, hard reason.
So emerging out of this, we have the Transcendental Movement, which is occupying or has a huge influence on early American history. And this is, a number of things came out of this. One was a reshifting of focus from a collective unit onto the individual. Another was this idea that nature's physical outward appearance is symbolic of invisible spiritual facets. And that combined with this idea of the sublime, which I'm going to come back to in a few minutes, was, again, very influential in the shaping of the American character. So we have people like Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who wrote that nature can be a temple in which to draw near and commune with God. So wild nature, what he considered to be wild nature, can serve higher human spiritual values as well as supplying the raw materials necessary for life. And then we've got Thoreau, who I think was very, very influential in bringing about a lot of this shift that we're talking about. Thoreau, actually, we've got some quotes out there by Thoreau. Does anyone have one that starts with B? There's A and B, and I want to start with B. Go ahead.
These are encouraging testimonies. If the moon looks larger than here than in Europe, probably the sun looks larger also. If the heavens of America appear infinitely higher and the stars brighter, I trust that these facts are symbolical of the height to which the philosophy and poetry and religion of her inhabitants may one day soar. For I believe that climate does thus react on man, as there is something in the mountain air that feeds the spirit and inspires.
Thank you. So there's a couple of things going on in that quote, but noticeably, Thoreau is talking about how much greater everything is here in America than in Europe. And this was very important because at his time, Americans were trying to determine what their identity was, and specifically their identity juxtaposed what was going on in Europe. So what does Europe have? Europe has the art, it has the architecture, it has the cathedrals, it has the languages, this long history. And in this desire to distinguish what was truly American compared to what was European, they looked around and they said, we have this vast, epic wilderness all around us, this majestic topography. This is what is American, and we'll embrace this as part of our identity to distinguish ourselves from that which is European. There's another Thoreau quote out there. Someone have that one? Mm-hmm.
Let me live where I will. On this side is the city, on that the wilderness. And ever I am leaving the city more and more and withdrawing into the wilderness. I should not lay so much stress on this fact if I did not believe that something like this is the prevailing tendency of my countrymen. I must walk toward Oregon and not toward Europe. And that way, the nation is moving. And I may say that mankind progresses from east to west.
So there's another couple of things highlighted in there. For Thoreau, West was equated with wild, and wild was equated with West, and it was good. And it was the place where humans went to be formed and shaped. It was, nature was the counter community. It was where you went to find your identity in a way as a human. This westward movement, what does this make you think of in American history? There's one particular phrase.
Oh, manifest
destiny. Yeah, so manifest destiny, this idea that Americans had the God-given and God-blessed right to move westward and settle and take over this land, and it was ordained that it should be so. And Thoreau is in this whole manifest destiny world as well. He equates that which is in the cardinal direction of westward as being the destiny of Americans. So wilderness is now, it's a symbol of American national character. It's this place that is calling to people. It's a place of yearning, and all of a sudden it becomes a very, very good thing. What else do I want to say about Thoreau? Nature teaches us what human life is and how to be human, and there's also this increasing sentiment that too much civilization can overripen a person. Too much time spent in the city is no longer good for someone. They ought to get out into the wilderness and spend more time there. So what we have with Thoreau is, first of all, that wilderness becomes an idea and not just a place. And we talked a little bit about this yesterday, but this is really coming into form at this point. It's not simply a geographic or physical location, but it's an idea, and it carries with it certain characteristics. And also, it's starting to represent something very, very different than it did before. He has this classic phrase in wildness is the preservation of the world. So Thoreau believed that wildness is the antidote to our human selves. Wilderness is the prized refuge from disease agents, and those disease agents are us humans. So that's sort of where we're left off with on Thoreau. It's furthering this dichotomy that was set up by Jonathan Edwards, although in reality much further before then, about humans and nature being entirely separate things. They're polar opposites, and that's going to be a powerful trend as we explore this theme as well. Yeah.
I'm just observing the pattern you're describing here, that our attitudes toward wilderness, this country, have gone from unfavorable to favorable, and the attitudes happen to coincide with the degree of control that we have over the natural environment.
Hmm. That's a good point. Yeah.
I mean, the people that settled New England had good reason to be scared of the wilderness.
Yeah, were you telling me on the boat about that book you were reading about the technologies? Maybe that was someone else. About how the railroad in particular was symbolic of representing increased human control and westward expansion. Was that you?
No, that wasn't me.
No, that wasn't you. Okay.
It's very true.
Well, yeah, thank you. So we're going to move along from the transcendentalists into two particular themes, and they're represented here by this map of America and the frontier that's moving westward. And then this very creative deck. Can anyone figure out what this is? Who said that? What is it?
Sublime.
Very nice. Isn't that clever? It's a lime, and then there's an arrow, so sublime. Yeah, so we're going to talk more about the sublime here. Yeah, John.
I have a question.
Oh, go ahead.
Did this romanticism and this turn to the positive view coincide around the time of the noble savage idea and the Last of Mohicans and all that sort of literature that was...
Yes.
Lifting up Native Americans as having special wisdom because of the way they lived.
Yes, I think that it did, but I would also say that those sentiments were still cloaked in pretty heavy racism. So it was this objectification, I think, in many ways, of the Native American as being full of the sort of natural wisdom and yet still not fully human.
But was that around the same time?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not a historian, but my understanding is that these were happening roughly in the late 18th and early 19th century, that these trends were emerging. Yeah. Anyone else want to shed any light on noble savage. Go ahead.
I read a book a few years ago. It was a novel. It was novelized history, and it was on the relationship between Europeans and Indians in the Ohio River Valley in the last half of the 18th century. Well, I didn't even know this was a problem. And I discovered, wow, there's just a tremendous amount of events went on, and the pattern became clearer and clearer. So by the time I was two-thirds of the way through the book, I just had to put the book away. I couldn't stand to read it any longer. And the formula was this. The more the Indians took on European ways, and the more that they became Christian, the more likely they were to be slaughtered.
Interesting.
If they wanted to be safe, they had to be like the Shawnees, which were the Nazis of the Ohio River Valley, and just fight the Europeans at every step, and they were the ones that were reasonably safe.
We're going to talk a bit more about Native American perceptions of the concept of wilderness on Thursday. Yeah. We'll get into that a little bit more. So I want to talk quickly about these two themes. So we'll start with the sublime. So the sublime, this is a word that we perhaps don't use as much anymore, and in many ways I think it's lost its powerful meaning. But this is an expression, again, of the Romantic movement. And someone out there has a poem by Wordsworth. Could that person read that poem, please? Thank you.
The immeasurable height of woods decaying, never to be decayed, the stationary blasts of waterfalls, and in the narrow rent at every turn, winds thwarting winds bewildered and forlorn, the torrents shooting from the clear blue sky, the rocks that muttered close upon our ears, black drizzling crags that spake by the wayside, as if a voice were in them, the sick sight, and giddy prospect of the raving stream, the unfettered clouds and region of the heavens, tumult and peace, the darkness and the light, were all like workings of one mind, the features of the same face, blossoms upon one tree, characters of the great apocalypse, the types and symbols of eternity, of first and last and midst and without end.
Thank you. So that's a poem by Wordsworth that in many ways kind of encapsulates this attitude of the sublime, of this sort of awesome fear and respect for nature, and also placing of the sacred within nature as well. So this is the idea that God shows God's self in these vast, natural, powerful landscapes where the human cannot but help to feel insignificant. So this is a powerful motif, again, that we're seeing as the American character is forming. And this little painting up here represents the Hudson River School painters. It was a school of artists that were really kind of representing these ideas in their paintings, paintings that would show, that would use light in these very novel ways, but that would present these dramatic landscapes that really don't resemble very much of upstate New York or the Berkshires of this area, but that were these dramatized infusing of the sacred into the landscape and kind of expressing the sublime in paintings. And this was also manifested in some of the earliest national parks that we have. So places like Yosemite and Yellowstone and Rainier and Zion and the Grand Canyon that are created around this special regard we had for things like mountaintops and waterfalls and chasms and canyons and rainbows and sunsets. There was this idea of the sublime being infused into nature. So there's still that thread of fear, but it's now also equated with something that is holy, something that is sacred, something that is fearful. And as this is happening, we're also seeing the sublime be replaced by a more subdued and domesticated perception of nature. So these trends are all kind of overlapping and happening at the same time. But this combined with this idea of the frontier, and this is crucial. So does anyone know who Frederick Jackson Turner was? He wrote his frontier thesis paper in 1893. He was a historian, and he was basically arguing that the frontier was this essential element of shaping the human character. It allowed settlers who were living along the frontier to shed the trappings of civilization and to rediscover their primitive energies and to reinvent democratic institutions and reinfuse themselves with a vigor and an independence and a creativity that he argues is the source of American democracy in many ways, and other things that he describes as being uniquely American. But it also matters that this frontier is moving westward. So it's moving and it's disappearing. And that all, the idea that there was this frontier and that it allowed certain people, namely white males, to behave in a certain way, but it was also disappearing. It was leaving. It was moving westward and would eventually disappear. That was also crucial in the shaping of the American character. So there's a Teddy Roosevelt quote out there that someone has. It has the letter D at the beginning. Could that person read that quote?
I have it.
Thank you.
There he passes his days. There he does his life work. There, when he meets death, he faces it as he has faced many other evils, with quiet, uncomplaining fortitude. Brave, hospitable, hardy, and adventurous, he is the grim pioneer of our race. He prepares the way for the civilization from before whose face he must himself disappear. Hard and dangerous though his existence is, it has yet a wild attraction that strongly draws to it his bold, free spirit.
So this is Roosevelt, thank you for reading it, describing the heroically masculine frontier rough rider and romanticizing and idolizing this character. This was always a masculine character, and civilization threatened the masculinity of this particular character. So again, it was sort of effeminizing civilization, emasculating the frontier, and again, privileging what the frontier represented and the wildness that was beyond it. So with the frontier motif, there's this powerful idea that we have to save wild lands because they were so crucial in making the American character. It's this remnant to our noble past. It's like saving the wild as a museum that will remind us and represent how we came about as a nation. So again, we're starting to see how wilderness is taking on a whole different set of values than it used to. And after the Civil War, what started to happen is that the wealthiest citizens began to seek out wilderness as recreational and tourism experiences. This was mostly the elite that were heading out there, and this is when we start to see a lot of these huge lodges and hotels being built in the national parks, that are many of which are still around today. But for many years, that was an escape for the elite in America to go and kind of get their dose of a wilderness experience. And it also made the wilderness, again, become sort of more tame and more safe so that these people could enter it and experience it and then leave and return back to civilization. So what we're gonna talk about next is what I'm calling some national campaigns and a really important ideological split in the way that wilderness is viewed. And it's represented by these two men. Can anyone guess who these two men are? They're both very angry because they're nemeses.
How about John Muir for one?
Yes, very good. This is John Muir. Who's John Muir's enemy?
Oh, his enemy.
It's a man named Gifford Pinchot, and we will we'll talk more about him in a minute. But let's start with Muir. So what do people know just about Muir as a person? Who was he? Where did he come from?
He went to the University of Wisconsin.
That's right, he did. Was he born in Wisconsin?
Scottish.
Yep, he's Scottish. His family moved over when he was 11 and moved to Wisconsin. Anything else?
Well, he had the good sense to leave Wisconsin.
Was he unhealthy?
Was he unhealthy?
Yeah.
He did die of an illness, but I don't know if throughout his life he was unhealthy. He was a naturalist. He had this fascination with the natural world. He actually walked from Indiana to Florida and intended to go down into the Amazon, but instead caught a boat to San Francisco. And when he got off the boat, he basically said, where is the wild land? And someone basically just pointed east from San Francisco to towards the Sierras, and he began walking and ended up spending a lot of time in Yosemite. So Yosemite was a real home for Muir, although he traveled to many other places, became a real political activist and a very, very influential person. He's the founder of the Sierra Club. He's been called the father of the national parks. He's been called a religious prophet and a mystic. He's been described as America's most eloquent spokesperson for the mystery and majesty of wilderness. And he experienced something of a spiritual awakening in Yosemite. And we've got two quotes out there by Muir. They're labeled E and F.
E.
Okay, let's hear that one.
Bathed in such beauty, watching the expressions ever varying on the faces of mountains, watching the stars which here have a glory that the lowlander never dreams of, watching the circling seasons, listening to the songs of the waters and the winds and the birds would be endless pleasure. No other place has ever so overwhelmingly attracted me as this Godful wilderness. Wasn't he the one that loved wind so much and he tied himself up into trees when there were storms? And
Yeah, he was. He would climb up to the top of these tall trees in Yosemite Valley when thunderstorms would come through and sway along with the trees, and he wrote these kind of long testaments.
And he would also initiate snow slides and ride them down.
Yeah, he would. And when there was an earthquake in Yosemite Valley, everyone else kind of cowered, and he ran out into the valley so he could experience the earthquake and kind of be around looking at it and feeling it. We have another quote. It starts with letter F. Go ahead.
Every particle of rock or water or air has God by its side, leading it the way it should go. The clearest way into the universe is through a forest wilderness. And God's wilderness is the hope of the world.
So that's a really interesting last line. In God's wilderness is the hope of the world. That was intended to mimic what Thoreau said, in wildness is the preservation of the world. But for Muir, the closer you are to the wild of wilderness, the closer you are to God. He was a very spiritual person. His father was a Presbyterian minister, and he kind of infused wildness with this deep spirituality. So a lot of Christian folks really like Muir's writing. There's a lot of books that are kind of drawing parallels between his spirituality and what he wrote. For Muir, wilderness was a window opening up into heaven, a mirror reflecting the Creator, and all parts of it are sparks of the divine soul. And he argued that wilderness was necessary for physical, mental, and spiritual health. And again, he's drawing this distinction between city folks and wilderness folks like himself. He says city people are tired, nerve-shaken, over-civilized, half-insane, choked with care like clocks full of dust, and bursting with rust and disease. So Jeff supposed that to what he considered himself to be, which was a sort of pure wild man out in the park. His philosophy exalted wild nature over human culture and civilization because he believed that all life was sacred and wilderness had value because it was untouched, put that in quotes, untouched by humans. That was a huge thing that Muir believed and that his writings introduced. There is very little, if any, indication from any of his tomes and tomes of writing that there were other humans living in Yosemite before he arrived. And that's something that we'll dive into a little bit more on Thursday. Now, the problem, of course, is that visiting wilderness both necessitates its preservation, but it also threatens its preservation. If you need it to be there and exist without human presence, then the more that you visit it, the more it kind of threatens its own existence by bringing human presence in there. So we're starting to see a real evolution now from Thoreau and the Transcendentalists, who had this very anthropocentric idea, meaning human-centered idea of what wilderness was. And Muir is slowly introducing more of a biocentric, the intrinsic value of wilderness. It has value just because it's there. It also has value because people like him get to go there and recreate there and be spiritually rejuvenated there. But the wilderness in and of itself, just the wilderness alone, has great important value. But Muir was also a political activist. I'm going to come back to you in a sec, Jack, but I want to finish this controversy. He was a political activist, and he hated that there were all these livestock grazing throughout Yosemite and up in the Tuolumne Meadows. And he felt that the state wasn't doing a very good job of managing the park, and it should be federally managed, federally mandated. And that's why he's called the father of the national parks. He ended up being instrumental in having Yosemite become a national park and then fall under federal management. However, one of the sort of tragedies of his life, in his opinion, was a dam that was built in Yosemite. Does anyone know the name of that?
Hetch Hetchy.
Yes, okay, good. So you do know a lot about that. So in order to talk about Hetch Hetchy, we have to talk about this guy, this angry man in a top hat. They're both angry because they're enemies. but his name is Gifford Pinchot, and he is the first chief of the U.S. Forest Service. And I won't really go into a lot of his biography, but he, this was a time in America, this was the progressive era, and he was arguing for a kind of conservation ethic that reflected the values of that time. So it reflected this populist, democratic, anthropocentric, and utilitarian ethic of the time. So for Pinchot, conservation meant the greatest good to the greatest number of people for the longest amount of time. And he felt very strongly that people could live off of the environment around them and yet renew that environment for generations and generations to come. And that was the best possible thing you could do with wild land. You could extract resources from it, but you had to do so sustainably. So it should be used for humans. Humans should benefit from this land as long as you do so in a way that allows future generations to also benefit from the extraction of those resources. So instead of Emerson and Thoreau's kind of nature with a capital N, he began to think of nature as little n natural resources. That was what nature and what wildness was to Pinchot. So why does this matter for wilderness discussion? Because you don't need to protect wilderness anymore. Wilderness can still be wilderness if it's serving human beings. We can still mine Copper Mountain as much as we want, and it's still wilderness, and we're still gaining a benefit from it. That was Pinchot's mindset. So these two figures came head to head. They started to butt heads over a project or a proposal to dam a valley in Yosemite called Hetch Hetchy. And the reason they wanted to dam it was to create a reservoir of water for the city of San Francisco over here. Demonstrated with three buildings and an airplane. And so in Pinchot's mind, this was the best possible thing you could do with Tuolumne. You were going to provide water for so many people, for this huge city full of people. And for Muir, this was sacrilege. So Pinchot said that damming the valley was the highest possible use which could be made of it. And Muir said, "Dam Hetch Hetchy, as well dam for water tanks the people's cathedrals and churches, for no holier temple has ever been consecrated by the hearts of man." So what we're starting to see here is the anthropocentric versus the biocentric, and the utilitarian versus the aesthetic. This real kind of split begins. And Pinchot comes to represent the conservation movement, what we call conservationists, which isn't conserve things and don't touch them and leave them as they are. It was develop and use resources. And Muir is the preservation movement and the preservationist, which is protect and basically leave as it is. And both of these two threads have been institutionalized in our government today, the National Forest Service and the National Park Service. When you go through national forests and you see the sign that says land of many uses, that's the Pinchot legacy of utilizing the resources in these forests versus national parks. A mile away, you enter the glacier wilderness and you're not supposed to have anything there but trails. And that's the preservationist kind of enshrined into the National Park Service.
That's Forest Service.
Pardon me?
That's Forest Service.
Glacier Wilderness is Forest Service?
Yeah.
Doesn't it say you're entering wilderness land here?
It's still
Forest Service.
The wilderness areas are administered by the Forest Service. Because there's really another odder split in that the national parks are built facilities so people can come and enjoy them.
Are built facilities?
Or
lodges.
Built lodges, built paved trails, built parking lots.
Right.
That's the national park approach. And Muir is more aligned with that.
Uh-huh.
And so the wilderness system is the Forest Service.
Yeah. However, we do have specific areas of national parks that are designated wilderness,
yes.
Right? Okay. I see what you're saying now. It's an interesting point. Are there any other comments or questions about where we've come up until now?
Wasn't there a painter or a photographer?
Ansel Adams.
Who had a lot to do with?
Yeah, Ansel Adams photographed a lot in Yosemite, and we're going to talk a little bit more about him on Thursday, because another thing Ansel Adams did, which Muir is guilty of as well, is excluding and denying the presence of human beings in this valley. So Ansel Adams would frame his photos so that it excluded any indication that there was human presence in these areas that he was photographing, and Muir ignored it as well. There were people living in Yosemite Valley for a long, long, long time before Muir showed up.
And they set fire to the valley.
And they did, yep. And they would cultivate the land in some ways. They were planting certain trees in the valley. It looked the way that it did because there was the imprint of humans on this valley. And yet when Muir showed up, it was this untouched, you know, virgin wilderness that no person, read, no white man had ever seen before. Okay, we'll move on to our last couple of sections here. So this is this arrow. This is one of our more creative depictions here. This is where we start to talk about a third major figurehead in this movement, which is Aldo Leopold. And I'll keep this pretty quick, but the reason why we have a bear and a mountain lion and a cow is because Aldo Leopold, who went to the School of Forestry at Yale, which Gifford Pinchot's family had helped found, and was trained in the sort of conservation utilitarian approach, was sent to be a forester in New Mexico and Arizona. And specifically, he was meant to deal with the issue of predators, because all of these game ranchers were very annoyed that predators kept killing off their cattle. And Leopold came to have this profound respect for the predators because he recognized them as being instrumental to the functioning of a healthy ecosystem. They belonged in there. So sort of skimming over a lot of what Leopold was about, he developed this land ethic. He ended up being kind of the premier expert on wilderness and wilderness management in the 1930s, and he founded the Wilderness Society in 1935, which in turn ended up being instrumental in passing the Wilderness Act of 1964. But Leopold believed that wilderness, what wilderness is and what wilderness is meant to do, is show what a healthy biotic community looks like. And this all came out of his experience of recognizing that predators belonged in this system, and when humans interfered too much, it threw things out of whack. So wilderness was a healthy, functioning biotic system, and that was why we needed wilderness. We needed to see what healthy land ought to look like. So skimming right through Leopold, we now enter this monkey here. Can anyone guess what this monkey might represent? Yeah, it's holding a wrench.
Monkey wrench?
Yes. So just, can anyone think of a book, perhaps, that might have been influential with the word monkey wrench in it? So it's called The Monkey Wrench Gang. Thanks, John. And it was written by Edward Abbey. And Edward Abbey is a pretty fascinating character. He ended up working as a park ranger in Arches before it was a national park in the 50s or 60s or maybe 70s. And he's also considered the father of ecoterrorism, of the Earth First Movement and Earth Liberation Front, which emerged later on. And Edward Abbey wrote this sort of angry polemic against what was happening to wilderness in the national parks, what he saw happening, which was that they were becoming very accessible to a lot of different people. Roads were coming in, and those roads were paved, which meant people could come in with their cars and their RVs, and they could access more of this wilderness land. And he was staunchly opposed to this in a way, and he expressed this in a way that made many people very, very angry, but he also has kind of this cult following. So he would say things like, you know, if you're a little kid and you can only get into the park through a car on a paved road, well, you know, too bad, just wait till you're older, until you can hike in or bike in or take a horse in. If you're older, then it's your own fault. You should have gone when you were younger. And if you have some kind of a disability, well, you know, too bad. You should just be happy that other people are out there experiencing the parks, because they should not be easy to access. There shouldn't be any roads in national parks, according to Ed Abbey. There should just be trails. You can bike in, you can take a horse in. But as soon as we make parks accessible to everyone, it ruins it. It ruins the whole nature of the park. So, understandably, this was a rather controversial stance that Ed Abbey took. And I think, actually, since we just have a few minutes left, let's just skip over Wallace Stegner, who was one of the, he helped the Wilderness Act get passed, and we'll just kind of talk about either Ed Abbey and his idea about accessing wilderness, or just open it up to other thoughts and comments from the rest of the presentation. Go ahead.
First of all, I thought this was great. second of all, there is, for those that live in Seattle, there is a fabulous art exhibit at the Seattle Art Museum on paintings of the Wild West, all the way through Yosemite. And it's from the 1800s, and it is exquisite, and it is extreme. Talks about, you know how you were talking about the Hudson Valley. Well, many of the paintings are very spiritually done. And the lighting and the technique is just so. If anyone's from Seattle, I urge you to see it because it's just outstanding.
And what is it again? The name of the place?
It says the Seattle Art Museum. It's an it's an exhibit, and there are European painters in it, but they went to Yosemite. And historically, it's very, very interesting. Now, aren't you at the UW?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have you seen it?
I haven't.
I urge you to see it. I think you'd really, really enjoy it.
Great. Do you know how long it will be there for?
I think it leaves September 11th, I think.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
It's been there for several months.
Let's go in the back, and we'll swing along here.
You were touching upon the sort of the different voices coming out between the Forest Service and the Park Service, but it seems to me that those voices have been there for a long, long time. They still remain. Whether you know how much leave untouched and to preserve the wilderness, and then how to let this being our land, this is the people's land, and isn't Ken Burns coming out with something on the parks? Or
he did. He had a PBS series on the national parks.
But I mean, I think it's been a dialect for a long time, and it is it's probably always going to be very sensitive.
Yeah. You know, the Wilderness Act, and it's not just the Forest Service and the Park Service, it's the Bureau of Land Management, it's Fish and Wildlife. There's a lot of different agencies that have a hand in deciding what purpose land is put to in this country. Mm-hmm. And although the Wilderness Act, in some ways, argues for the intrinsic value of wilderness, it existing just for the sake of it existing because it has worth, there are a whole slew of exceptions written into that act that actually end up privileging more kind of anthropocentric and utilitarian uses of the land.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right that tension is definitely still there.
Like up in the Arctic, for instance. In Alaska.
So something that Edward Abbey, for example, would say about a place like Anwar is, even if you never ever go there, you should be happy that it exists. That should be enough. You don't have to set foot in any of these places to value it. Simply knowing that it's there and understanding its intrinsic worth should be enough for you to fight for its existence. So again, it's this kind of exclusivist entry into the debate. Let's go, John, and then over here. I'm going to go to people we haven't heard from yet.
Just wanted to ask you to explain what monkey wrench is, because you mentioned the book, but say what that is.
A monkey wrench is a tool that was used. Well, I didn't know that.
Monkey Wrench Gang.
Yeah, so the Monkey Wrench Gang is the title of a book that's considered to be the handbook for ecoterrorism. So the monkey wrench could be used for all kinds of acts of ecoterrorism. They would spike trees so that when you'd come to cut it down, it would damage the saws. They would pour sand into the gas canisters of tractors. They would, these days it takes on kind of more complex acts like Earth Liberation Front will set fire to laboratories that are conducting tests on genetically modified organisms, things like that. Earth First doesn't seem to be as strong anymore as it used to be, but in its heyday, they were very inspired by Ed Abbey. Was there a hand on the side?
It's hard to be active from jail.
Yeah.
They recently got some convictions.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, and then we'll go over to Janet.
You were talking about nature in balance kind of thing. There was a classic case where in the north part of Grand Canyon, they went in and they killed the cougars.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a tremendous explosion in the deer population because the cougars were not attriting. And then there was a crash of the deer population starving because there was no forage for them, and it went down to about a quarter of what they had been with the cougars there.
Mm-hmm.
And now they reintroduced the cougars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Population dynamics. Let's have one last comment. Jack, if you can keep it short, let's go with you, and then we'll come over and end over here.
We often, well, not often, but we generally romanticize the pioneer experience. And, of course, pioneers that came into the what is now the Great Lake region, by and large, meant endless forest. And so they come in and they build a shed to house themselves in. And the next thing they would do would be to girdle the trees. Then the trees would all die. But in the spring, they could plant corn in between the trees. And then, during the succeeding winters, they would log off the property. And that's the process that they used to tame the land.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Last comment?
Yeah, you mentioned John. He certainly was evangelist. But the muscle came from Theodore Roosevelt.
Yeah. John Muir and Theodore Roosevelt ended up going camping together in Yosemite for a couple of days, and Muir used that as an opportunity to try as much as he could to convince Roosevelt that there needed to be a federal program for protecting these wild lands and that the national parks ought to exist. And then, you're right, Roosevelt was moved by that experience and took it very seriously and started, yeah. Great. All right, well, thank you everyone for coming. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about why wilderness doesn't exist. Enjoy the rest of your day.